Now please welcome our Al-Anon speaker, Matthias Gea.
Thank you. My name is Matthias, and I'm an adult child to my mother, who is an alcoholic.
Hi, Matthias. We love you, Matthias. Lots and lots and lots.
Thank you. Yeah. Who are you kidding? I know you don't like me. I'm from the other side. I'm the all-unknowner. I still remember that night. I was a dead man walking in a nice suit. I was running and hunting that forest trail. The rain was whipping into my face, and I couldn't barely see the path because it made the visibility equal to zero. But I could still find that path because I had been running that path during my whole life. I knew every stone, every tree, and there was no problem with that part. And I ran that trail with a very tense pace, very fast pace. I could feel every heartbeat in my temple, and I had that taste of blood in my mouth, you know, when you are pushing yourself to the limit. I was high on adrenaline and endorphins up to my eyeball. But I also felt very tired this night, close to sick. And I was turning up on a bridge that took me over the channel, and I turned out on a small trail of gravel or something. And I suddenly felt a very strong feeling of dizziness. And in the same moment, something warm was streaming over my lip, and I realized it was blood from my nose. My body was out of use, and it made everything it could to tell me that. But I lived my life with a pedal to the metal, and I pushed and I pushed. And I lost the balance, and I was free falling into the gravel. And I still don't today know what hurt most, my scraped body or the internal pain in that moment when my superficial facade went down like a tree in a storm. What I am trying to tell you here is what I was addicted to, because I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, and I didn't use any drugs, but I was addicted to excitement. You know, I was running in the forest when you guys were down at the pub. And I loved it, you know. I was running from shame, guilt, unworthiness. I think some of you maybe could also relate to that. And training was a short-term quick fix for me to get out of the coal basement. I call it the coal basement. It was when I it was my own emotional life. And I needed these kind of quick fixes, training, I involved myself in crazy relationships, you know, the person left, did plastic surgery, came back, same person, new face, and I slept with the enemy again, you know. It's a long story. So every time I had that kind of quick fix, I thought I was staring at the light at the end of the tunnel, but that light was a train loaded with feedback from all of the bad choices that I made during my life. And I made a lot of them. So this sick blueprint knocked me to the ground. You know, my drug, another favorite drug was sex. It's a very good way to escape pain. Yeah. You know, sex was fueling my codependency like a NOx gas fueling a NASCAR or something. It was very strong, and when I lay there in the mud, I realized that I had a moment of clarity, and I took a decision that I felt that I need help. So the next day, I wrote down 5 names, and I called the person. We can call him Yoda. And I met Yoda for the first time maybe 10 years earlier, you know, that little green guy in Star Wars. And I didn't remember, even if he told me back in the days that he was sober in AA. But that was not the reason, because I just called him because I needed someone to talk with. And I could remember that I really liked that guy. I called him, and we haven't been spoken for maybe 5 years, but we spoke for 3 hours. But he is always telling me that I spoke for 3 hours. He was just listening. And he invited me over to Oslo, and actually he's living in Gothenburg, but he should be in Oslo for a while. So I flew over to Oslo, and you know, at the first lunch, he dropped the first plasma shell right into my heart. You are codependent. And I asked, what? I mean, he may be sober in AA, but what the hell is this guy smoking? Codependent. But I went back to my hotel room, and I bugged the internet for everything that I could find about codependency. And the next day, we hooked up, and he asked me what I thought about his remarkable idea about the codependency. And I told him that I am a little bit codependent. And he just, he swung this lightsaber over and over and hit me. And he told me, Matthias, is it possible for a woman to be a little pregnant? No. So we made a deal. I flew back to Stockholm, and the deal was that I should attend 10 meetings. And, you know, I did one meeting every week, so that took approximately 2 months or something. So it was a slow start. But I still remember my 9th meeting, and it was some kind of organizing meeting, and the leader was asking who should brew coffee, who should take the key. And I was sitting at my peak of arrogance and just thought, oh, don't look at me, because I have one meeting left and then I'm out of here. But something happened, and I continued, and I started to work in that program, this program. And I still remember, you know, of course I had a lot of challenges because things wasn't easier or in the program. It's very hard to start from the beginning, you know. If you have been running 30 years out in the forest, even if I wanted it, it will not take 1 hour back to the main road. You know, even if I running like hell, it's a hard work, and sometimes I also need to stop and rest, patient, you know. And one thing my sponsor told me was that, "Hi, Mathias, you must have your pants on. No sex for a year." And okay, I still remember it. I asked, "What? What is this?" But so of course I made my relapse, and I can really think what you guys is thinking about. Now you think that this Al-Anon guy is really crazy. Is he telling me that I can't have sex for a year or what? But I think my addiction was the excitement, and I think it's impossible for me to recover if my mind is hijacked by endorphins. That was the thing I always hunted and needed to stop being with my own emotional life. So I did it. I did 1 year. That's good. maybe I can get a coin for that, because the clock is still ticking. And yeah, but the hardest thing for me were what I could see today is that my self-esteem was gone, and that's the I'm blown away right now. It was that sex thing. Maybe I was too honest. You know? Yeah, I'm looking forward for the party. Yeah. You know, I'm a recovered, humble man. Yeah. So, I think the time is also ticking away here. Jay will soon drag me off the stage. But this program have been helping me a lot, and today I'm a living man walking in a nice t-shirt, so thanks.
Thank you, Matthias. Now please welcome our main speaker for this evening, Marge D. from London, England.
Hi everyone, my name is Margie and I'm an alcoholic. I really like this Rocky Horror Picture Show part stuff, you know, where you're really coming in and going, waiting for the lighters to come out. I just find it amazing to be here. This is just terrific. I mean, the guys that have put this together are just phenomenal. It is astounding what you have done as far as putting this together, really and truly. I'm going to put this down here so I don't knock it over. They've been working on it for a long time. They've been campaigning. Peter came to London and did a lot of work there. I've been talking to Jay. All the people that have put this together. It's really service to the nth degree. And you should get some kind of a medal for that, actually. Like I said, my name is Margie. And I'm an alcoholic. You can just skip that other part. We already did that. And obviously, I'm not originally from London, although I've been there for many, many, many years. And I consider that one of my spiritual homes. But I am truly, and down to the core, in every part of my DNA, I am an alcoholic. And that is in thinking and physically and every other way that an alcoholic can be defined. First sponsor, Dale the Hippie, the knower of all, used to tell me to say my sobriety date whenever I shared, because people need to know. If you're new, you need to have new friends and connect up with the program. And if you've got a longer-term sobriety, then people need to know also that it is possible to live your life without having to take a drink, a drug, or anything else. My sobriety date is November 6, 1979. So... Yeah. I'm impressed. You know, I was like, yeah, I can hear it. I can hear your voices in there going, she's been sober longer than I've been alive. And yes, I have. I have been sober most of the, yeah, which is, you know, just... It's just that's just freaky to me. Just using the word freaky tells you how old I am. And if you were to ask how old I am, it would, you know, counting fingers and toes, it would take almost three of you to get my age. So I did come into the program quite young for that time, back in the Jurassic period of AA. I was considered quite young, quite the catch, actually. Yeah, mainly then it was, you know, it was kind of frightening. It was a bit frightening. It is kind of the, you know, what you always feared the most that AA was, at least where I was. I got sober in Miami, but I'll get to that in a minute. I was born in Rhode Island. For people who don't know that, you may know the TV show Family Guy. I'm from there. I'm from Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and Woonsocket, Rhode Island. And that just explains, go watch a few episodes, it'll explain my history, because I am our family was exactly like that. Horrifying, actually. I actually know some of the people in the cartoon, which is, again, frightening. But I grew up in Rhode Island, from Irish, Polish, English, Roman Catholic family, and there was no way I was getting out from being an alcoholic. There just wasn't, you know. With that kind of background, you automatically, you just roll them in. We were Catholic, as they used to say, to the nth degree. We were Irish and Polish, and it was drink and church. If you go to Rhode Island, you can see it. Bar, church, store. You know, in that order. And so it was just part of that. And I do believe that my DNA was inherited from people, from a long line of alcoholics. I mean, I had, you know, some people, you know, you hear it now and again where I am the only alcoholic in the family. Well, I was not the only alcoholic in the family. Everybody in the family was an alcoholic. You know, they used to like to have fun. They used to like to dance, and they used to like to drink. And after you're in an X amount of a time in an event at the weddings, the joke was, you know, I went to a picnics or whatever. The joke was, I went to a fight and a Polish picnic broke out. And that's basically, you know, they just, you know, fight all the time, drink, then dance some more, and then get pissed off about something else and you'd fight some more. And, you know, it's just, that's just the way that people were, you know, where I was from. And that's what you expected. And I didn't really know any different at the time. It came later. So I grew up there. And again, very, you know, we had the nuns of Navarone teaching us. And they were fairly, I think they're nicer now. But back then, they took glee in smacking you and, you know, rulers on the hands and other forms of medieval torture. And, you know, making sure you knew that even when you're born, you have original sin already. You're not even, you haven't even said anything. You don't have any chance to learn how to walk. You're already doomed. So, you know, it was like there was no way of getting out of it alive without getting burned in hell. And I think that's why I moved to Arizona to acclimatize, you know. Because it is kind of like living on the sun there. So, I mean, you know, I had the, you know, childhood. I mean, back in those days, they didn't watch children like that. They didn't strap them down into cars. You know, we'd just go over a bump and go into zero gravity, you know, kind of floating around in the car. And it was very kind of lackadaisical. And the kid, you know, we left the house at 9 o'clock in the morning, came back at 5 o'clock at night. And, you know, the pedophiles were chasing us. And, you know, but it just was different. It was just different then. And so it was a little less. We were a little less watched, and we just did what we wanted. As I went into high school, I was not the queen of the prom, but then I figured out, you know, there's only one. There was 435 other of us that weren't the queen of the prom either, so I can't really use that as an excuse. Like, oh, I wasn't queen of the prom, I wasn't popular. That's why I drank. It's like, well, what about all these other people? There's only one queen of the prom, and it turned out she was an alcoholic, so there you go. You know, I just had a normal kind of a high school kind of experience. I didn't do a lot of drinking then, but when I started getting into, I can't even say this, because this is a young people's conscience. Do you understand? I understand the irony of my being here. Because let's face it, if I need three people to add up my age on their toes and fingers, it's not exactly like I'm a young person. But the summer of 1968 and 70, 69 and 70, it was kind of required of American teenagers back then. I was a teenager back then to, you know, get stoned, listen to Jimi Hendrix, Pink Floyd, smoke pot, eat Cheetos, and drink rot gut wine. You know, Boone's Farm and Ripple and Bally High and just this rotten stuff. But it didn't really kick in then. But that was kind of required at that time, you know, flowers in your hair and peace and love and blah, blah, blah. And it didn't really kick in then, but I got my introduction to it then. I used to like ginger brandy then. I married my high school sweetheart for 6 months, and I went into it with the wrong idea. I was walking down the aisle and going, well, I could always divorce him, couldn't I? Which I don't think was the right thought to bring forward. And after that is really when... after I was in my 20s. I was just a 19, 20 kind of thing, and... that's when I really started to kick in, you know. We got into the 70s, 71 and that kind of thing. And I had I wasn't drinking to a point where it was out of control at that point. There is a point, I think, in every alcoholic's life where, you know, you're going along. Some people start off bang, and they're drunk every day. But other people start off as kind of a slow slide. And then at some point, you can't really see the edge. When you've gone over the edge, you just find yourself falling and going over the edge. And there's no way you can't go back up because there's nothing to grab onto. And I think everyone has felt that. That's an alcoholic, that the edge is now gone and there's no place else but down. And that happened to me later. It didn't happen eventually. I started to go out. At that time, I used to go out to dance to meet what was then euphemistically called boys. Drinking was part of it, and that's what we would do. We would go out, and that was the plan. And basically, disco was my downfall. When I started going out into the world and drinking and all this stuff, at some point during the disco years, I'm not sure exactly when, sometime between everybody was kung fu fighting and Saturday Night Fever, I lost it. You know, that edge, I just kind of come in and there she goes and she's gone. And that happened. I don't know exactly when that happened, but it did. My brother-in-law, who used to, my family was restaurateurs and catering, and you know, so he had a bar kind of restaurant. And I used to go in there when I first started out, and so cute, you know. I love this phrase in England that they use to go, "Oh, bless," and it just covers such a lot of territory. I used to drink these drinks with mixers. You know, they were red, and they'd have umbrellas and fruit on little plastic swords, and it was so cute, you know. And I went out, and you know, it was alcohol. And then within a year, so stupid, within a year of that, and this is why it came on pretty, that my brother-in-law noticed. He said, "You used to come in here and drink, you know, these girly little why bother drinks." And by the end of that, I was drinking 15 Wild Turkeys straight a night. I got rid of the ice. I got rid of the mixers. I got rid of the accoutrement, you know, and I downed it, and I was drinking the Baraducci brothers under the table. They were from Providence. We weren't quite sure what they did, but we think it was the funereal business, if you get my drift, or waste disposal, one or the other. And I used to drink them under the table, Vinny and Barry Baraducci, and drive them home after having 18 Wild Turkeys. So, I switch over to other forms of heavy alcohol. So it kicked in, and I didn't drink because, I mean, I had traumas and I had things, and my grandmother's died, and you know, all kinds of things happened in my life as I went in. But I didn't drink because I was shy. I didn't drink because I was, you know, upset. I didn't drink because I was insecure. I didn't drink because I was angry. I drank because I was an alcoholic. And I used those excuses. This, for me, this is what an alcoholic does. They use, here's a life circumstances. That's our response to it. Some people go out and they find a therapist. You know, imagine. Some people go out and they do some voluntary work. Some people yell at somebody. Alcoholics, it's like, well, something emotional happened to me. Of course, I drink, you know. And it's not the emotional stuff that takes, it's our response to it. As an alcoholic, there is no other response. You have to drink, because that's what we do. My alcoholism was alive then, and I didn't recognize it as that just then. I assumed I was making these decisions myself. It's a good idea to go out and, you know, smash the car up and come in at 4 in the morning and don't know what city you're in. I'm in control, you know. My boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, was a Pawtucket, Rhode Island cop. And, yeah, that didn't go over too well. But I T-boned. In other words, I drove into the side of the South Attleboro, Massachusetts fire chief's car with his car, driving drunk. That didn't go over too well either. And then they gave me a loaner car while my room was being fixed, and I ran that one into something else. So I used to do, you know, and so, but I'm still like, yeah, so I've got everything's under control. Okie dokie. So I went on and on like that, and boyfriend left, of course, and that kind of thing. I got into all kinds of accidents. I drove drunk every day, and that's when I look back at it now, and I understand at that point, I would just say, well, I just go out at night, and I just have a couple of drinks, and sometimes it's out of hand, but I'm young, and blah, 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 and, you know, that's what you do, of course. And but now I look back on it, and for me, it is the clock. The clock. At 12 o'clock every day, midnight, I was either drinking, driving drunk, crashed out somewhere with someone I really didn't know who the name was. I wouldn't call myself promiscuous. I would prefer to use the phrase frisky. doing that, landing home, passing out into an alcoholic coma, getting up in the morning because I had to go to work to finance this whole rigmarole, driving again to work, half in the bag, swearing to God on the Bible that I would not drink that day because I suffered from hangovers terribly. I wasn't smart enough to take a little drink in between time. I just suffered the whole day drinking Alka-Seltzers and eating and getting rehydrated and what that. And then at about 3:30, see, I started to feel a little better. And then it started talking to me again. Well, feeling all right? What the hell? You can just go out for one, you know? Yeah, I can do that. And then I drive to the drinking, do the drinking, and then we're back at 12 o'clock. But I would have told you that the only thing that I'm doing is having a few drinks at night. But my entire life, every action, every moment of the day was dictated, either how I felt cleaning up the mess of what I did before. The entire day was lost in alcoholism in one form or shape of another. It doesn't, not necessarily the complete drinking, but recovering from it, whatever. And I can see that now, but I didn't see that then. And I think that's why we lose a lot of people. And a lot of people die or in car crashes and that kind of thing. I drove drunk every day. Every day I drove drunk, which I find amazing because when I was 17, my father was killed by a drunk driver in a head-on collision. And yet, during that time that I was functioning as an alcoholic, I made a decision that somehow this was a good idea to get in a car and put the world at risk and drive drunk. And I don't know how I did that, but that's what alcohol dictated to me. And I didn't know it was the alcoholism. I thought it was me making that decision, and it wasn't. So. Obviously, I got in a lot of trouble. I never went to jail, which I should have every single day. I lost a lot of relationships because I was just a gigantic, colossal pain in the ass, which I think we all are when you're drunk. You know, if you see a drunk now, you're going, oh, God, you poor thing. But, God, could we be annoying? You know, and I was, you know, let me repeat the same thing 50,000 times in your face while I'm breathing on you. Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's attractive. So, of course, alcoholics, and I really didn't know it was the alcohol. And again, I think that's why we lose a lot of people, because they don't really have a cognitive connection that what is going on in your life is directly connected to alcohol. And they have the layman's view of an alcoholic is this, lives under a bridge, past this age, ties their coat with a rope, you know, and those kinds of things. You know, and they're just cliches of what an alcoholic is. And because I don't fit into those little categories, I'm not an alcoholic. So it doesn't have to be the alcoholic, so we don't have to think about that. So it goes on to something else. It must be a relationship. It must be not enough money. It must be this. It must be that. And the alcoholism keeps the real problem hidden under here. And people are not, and then we lose them. They die. They get killed. They kill other people. And I find that it's not out of denial per se. I think it is out of ignorance. Ignorance being that they don't know what an alcoholic is and that their problems are related to that. So I moved to Miami, which was great because that's eventually where I got sober in a coral room in Miami. Now, the pièce de résistance of my drinking, because I was there a year and then I got sober. When you're feeding the subpersonality of alcoholism, your decision making is terrible, you know. So what is an alcoholic with, you know, years of drinking and no thinking and living through hangovers? What kind of a decision are they going to make about, yes, I found the man of my dreams? It's just not going to happen. So I went to Miami, and I did. In my mind, you know, people, places, things. The place, Miami, hey, you know, how can you go wrong? The person... He was a Learjet pilot. I mean, what else could you ask for? So, and he drank more than I did. And he used to throw me over his shoulder and carry me up the stairs and whatnot. So I went to Miami and I met this person, A, driving a white Corvette. That should have been the tell-all sign right there, you know. But I was like, this is the, you know, I knew something was wrong. You know, Rhode Island didn't work out for me. I had to kind of split town. And I did have this underlying feeling that something was wrong, other than, you know, I mean, I could see that alcohol was starting to work its way in. But I also had this underlying feeling that I'm missing something here. There's something that I'm not getting. There's something that I don't understand. There's something that I think I'm supposed to do, but I'm not doing it, and I don't know how to find that. And it was just kind of a little discontent that was kind of coming to my consciousness. So I figured, you know, going to Miami would be great. And so, you know, to assuage this this discontent, I hooked up with this man who had lots of money. Flew a Learjet here, there, and everywhere, which was, you know, interesting to me. Drank more than I did. Financed my drinking. You know, I never got into drugs. I mean, they were laying cocaine down in the cracks of the sidewalk back then. That was just like 1977, 78. The cocaine cowboys were, that's where all the cocaine you ever did came from. And I really wasn't interested into it, other than it is a, it was a tool for me to drink more. That's it. Do the coke, drink more. And that was it. I never bought it. I never did it. And of course I had, you know, this person financing that. And one day he flew off. See, I'm thinking he's going off. This is what I was told. He was going off and flying around Japanese businessmen. And one day he flew off and never came back. And I kind of tracked him down and found out what was going on, what's going on here. And I was drinking straight vodka all the time by this time. And I found out that his jet had gone down in the Everglades. He crashed in the Everglades, and they were all about to attend his funeral. So I went off to the funeral, and at the funeral, I found out he was married with 3 children. Forgot to mention that. And that actually, he wasn't actually flying Japanese businessmen. He was actually making business trips to Bogota, Colombia. And he had a business disagreement, and they basically shot him out of the sky. And I was politely asked, you should get out of town. So I did. And I came back in 6 months. And very soon after that, I came into AA because I really started drinking. And although he was, not what he proposed, I still was hurt that he would die, because at that point I did love him. I was getting over that. So that was, you know, that my drinking then escalated to a point that was ridiculous. I drank all the time. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I couldn't work. I was working at my sister's bar and restaurant. She had a one down there. And it was complete chaos. And I came into the program, and 6 months later, after this happened, I found out that he actually had faked his own death and was living in Bimini. So... that was the man of my dreams right there. So, gathering these pieces of information together, I really, you know, I couldn't stop drinking then. I knew that. I knew that death was upon me. I could feel it. I could smell it coming near me. I had this real insight that I was going to die very soon. And it's funny, because quite sure that alcoholics are that afraid of death. because what we do, and we continue to do, it's like death is kind of like, well, if you're drinking, that's kind of part of the deal, isn't it? But I was afraid, that little sneaking suspicion, that there was something that I needed to do other than just run around with these cocaine convoys and stuff, was really, it was banging hard on the inside of my head. And I think what eventually drives a lot of alcoholics to find some help is that they answer that. It's sort of like dying. I didn't want to die with the music in me. I didn't want to die with this thing that I was supposed to be or do inside me still, and then just dying this pathetic death, either somebody murdering me or driving into something and missing that. It wasn't so much the death that bothered me, but the other did bother me a lot, and I could feel it coming up. And I do think that that was my higher power going, excuse me, do something, and do it now. It's very funny because I think, it's funny, I've got these little angel wings on the back, but I think angels of AAs and alcoholics come in all forms. Mine came into a form of a girl named Joanne, who, if you've ever seen the series Cheers, there is a waitress in there called Carla, and Joanne was like that. She was a very, very scary person. She was about this high, about the size of a gnome, and she just was nasty. And I was working with her, and she was just like, "You're killing yourself." I had gotten into a car wreck and broken the vertebrae in my neck and in my back, and my face was all, my teeth had come through my lip. And I was a mess. And she just was like, she's like, "That's it. You're coming with me." She was the kind of person, if she gave change, she would give change for drinks like they do over here. You buy a drink and give her change. And if you put coins on it, she'd look at it and go, "Do I look like I take the bus?" And she would make it take it back and give her paper money, a fiver and stuff. So you didn't say no to her. She put me in her Cadillac convertible with the top down. She said, "Get in the car." And I got the car, and she basically drove me by the coral room and opened the door. I don't think she stopped even. Opened the door, rolled me out like tumbleweed, and that's how I got here. And she drove away, and I saw her maybe twice more in my life, but that's who got me there. And I rolled into AA like that, not knowing what the hell to do, because I think the trauma of the boyfriend dying and then, you know, under this and then that, and the overall consumption that I do, and in that, it was that feeling of there's something that I'm missing here, there's something that I was missing here, and I continue to drink because that's in my DNA. My alcoholism wants me to drink, and it will tell me any kind of a story that I need to hear for me to make that decision to drink. And it is. It's like being cohabitated by another personality whose, my intention is to live a full life, and my intention is to do good, and my intention is to achieve some certain things, and its intention is the complete opposite. It is, you know, George Campbell's hero with a thousand faces. It's Darth Vader and Skywalker. It's all of that, and it lives within me, and I know that. And there was that part that still wanted to drink, and there was the part that wanted something else. So I listened to her, because I don't know why. And when I came in, I was the youngest one in the group at the time. Obviously not now, but at the time, I was the youngest person in the group. And I thought to myself, even though I didn't know what to do, I was in grief, I was this, I was drunk, I was falling apart, I was all of that stuff, I looked around, and God bless these old codgers, but they were a million years old to me, and they were all smoking their cigarettes right down to the end. You know, the thing that if somebody says AA, oh, it's going to be full of old people, and they're all going to be, oh, God, you know, they were just like that. You know, they were your AA nightmare, and there was me with the, you know, like now, hair and, you know, all this other stuff, and sparkles. Yeah, I still do this, don't I? Sparkles in the day, and all that, high heels, and they were just like, oh, my God. And I walked in, and all the core room is open all day. If you ever go to Miami, it's open from 7 in the morning till midnight. and you can stay there all day, and you can go to meetings all day, and it was basically my treatment center. And they just walk around all day, sit in the same spot in the same plastic sofa every day, and the same things, reading the same papers. I think they were from like 1895 or something, reading these papers, cigarettes down, and little Burns going, "Yeah, well, don't drink, go to meeting. Don't drink, go to meeting." You know. God, you know, there was this one guy, I don't know why, decided to call me Genevieve. Fine, whatever. Hey, Genevieve, how's it going? And he had orange boat shoes, and I always remember seeing them sliding by because he never picked them off the pavement. He just kind of shimmy across the floor, going, and his orange, "You all right, Genevieve? Don't drink, go to meeting," you know. I don't remember my first year other than that. I learned, you know, but you know what? They're absolutely right. Even now, after all this time, don't drink and go to meeting is a very profound statement. If you don't drink, obviously you don't get drunk. If you go to a meeting, you will hear what you need to hear to stay sober that day. You'll hear what you need to do to hear for a long-term sobriety. You'll hear another person's story someone that needs to help. You'll get an opportunity to do that. You'll hear everything that you'll need to hear to live a sober life. And they were right, because that's the way I live my life now, is that I don't drink and I go to a meeting. And at the meeting is everything I need to know, do, say, hear, read to keep myself sober. So I was in this group with these old codgers, which they had an old codger table that if you were 20 years sober, you could go sit at. And then when I got 20 years sober, because they were laying bets across these tables going, "She's never going to stay sober. Look at her. Jesus Christ." You know, and "She's never going to stay sober." And they when I got 20 years sober, I'm like, "Okay, where's my seat?" We were saying we moved it to 25. I was like, "Oh, shit." I sat there last time I went. And so they got me sober, and I got a sponsor. Dale the Hippie had come in a few years, and she was the knower of all things, and not interested in any of my complaining whatsoever, which was great. It's like, "But I'm having a bit. I don't care about your day, you know. What are you doing?" You know, and which was perfect for me because it gave me instructions. And when I came in, of course, I said about the Catholic thing, which works for a lot of people, but it just didn't, you know, coincide with my vibe, as it were. And I saw the steps on the walls, and I was kind of agnostic because, you know, God was kind of beaten out of me then. And I thought, "Oh, my God, what am I going to do? How am I going to reconcile this?" Because I was listening with my alcoholic filter. You know, it's like we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. This is what I heard. "You're a terrible, rotten drunk, and you have to tell everybody about it." That's what I heard. I was like, "Oh." But admit to me is like with your arm up around the back of your neck. Admit it, you know. And it's like, "What?" You know, it came to believe that a power greater than myself can do it. You know, to me, that's God will fry you if you drink again. You know, this is what I was hearing. This is the way I was listening to what they were saying to me. And you know, and that's all right, because I think you have to go through that reinterpretation of how things are, because you come in with a template of how to listen and how you interpret the world and how you move in the world. And from an alcoholic point of view, this is not a pretty picture or constructive in any way. So it is that kind of picking it off and reinterpreting and bringing it down. You know, I went through the mechanics of staying sober, and I think that's all you need to do in the first while. Stay sober. Don't drink. "No, I ain't going to meeting. No, drink. Go to meeting." Just don't drink and go to meeting. Don't drink and go to the meeting. And then after a while, it's like you can see people. There were this motorcycle group that used to come to the group, Leather and Lace, and there was about 50 of them that used to come in on a Sunday night to this meeting, and they were big book bashers, like in the head kind of big book bashers. And they all had, so there's a motorcycle club in the States, and they'd all ride in, and whenever they brought a new recruit, you could always tell, because he'd keep his mirrored sunglasses on in the meeting and never smile. Never, ever smile. And then after a while, you know, you start to see teeth. And it's like, "Okay, hey, you must have gotten your 3 months chip, you know, and you take off the sunglasses. And it was just like a miracle to see these guys because they were so hard-nosed, and they're all like, I'm really grateful to my sponsor, you know, oh, God. So I came in. What I was listening to, and gradually over time that I it changed for me, was the steps. You know, they talk about it doesn't say to do anything. It doesn't say to do anything. The steps do not tell you to do anything. I heard it that way. It's a retrospective. It's like an interview. It's like, so what'd you do? Well, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our lives are becoming manageable. Really? Then what? Well, then we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to seriously. No kidding. Well, then what? Well, then we make a decision to turn your life and your will over to a power. And I was like, oh, they're just saying what they did. They're not telling you to do anything, because as an alcoholic, I'll tell you what, I got armor up here, and you want to mess at me? Okay. I know karate. Don't come near me. I don't want you near me. And so gradually, and I think that approach is brilliant. There is a certain amount of genius in AA, and I'm not sure it is divinely inspired, I believe, just because of that. And I didn't notice that for a long time, that it was all written in the past tense. It's just what someone did. Take it or leave it. Do them if you don't. If you want to get better, you can do them. You can just leave them there if you want. It does say in the book, you can drink if you want. You want to go out and drink? Drink. Go ahead. Come back and tell us how it was. You know, it's not going to... It's like it says it's worth the case of the jitters, you know, from that thing. So you can take it as much as you can. That's why I used to like to listen to these people, because they just told me, this is what I did. This is what I did, you know. And it was a different approach completely. And for me, as being an alcoholic personality who's, you know, defenses up, that was exactly what I needed. And that's the way... It filtered through to me after a while, and it didn't happen immediately. And there's no big rush. You can do this for the rest of your life. You know, if you don't want to drink, you don't drink. And if you come to a meeting, and then it all kind of washes over you. All the information starts to infiltrate your DNA. And I gradually came to. I was hoping that something could change. I don't know why I stayed. Why would you stay with a bunch of old guys in orange boat shoes calling you Genevieve, smoking cigarettes down in the end? You know, why would you do that? It's like, geez. I don't know why I stayed, but there was something. There was a piece that I said, you know, if I do this, there was some hope. Because before that, you know, the way that my life was going, the direction that it was going in, and I was quite young, you know, to begin. It was hard. It was hard. But I stayed for whatever reason. I don't know what. And I do believe that that is that divine inspiration. And after a while in the program, that's when I started to actually have faith in it, because I could see it working. At that point, there were a lot of young people starting to come in. Just about, I came in 1979. So 1980, 1981, a lot of young people started coming into the program. And we did a lot of work with FICIPAR, the Florida International Conference of Young People of AA, and in 1986 we had the ICIPA convention in Miami, which was wonderful. And you know, young people in AA goes back to 1958. You know, I would say before I was born, but I'd be lying. So and I do believe it was divinely inspired, because the big book was written when these guys were 5 years sober. If you start reading, you know, Pass It On and the Language of the Heart and the Good Old Timers and all that stuff, these guys were crazy as bedbugs, you know, trying to form this thing. And somehow this thing has emerged. I think it's been excavated. I think it was divinely inspired and it was handed to these guys. And they looked at it and they were trying different things and doing different ways. I mean, the Washingtonians and the Oxford group kind of had a deal on it, and they did take from that. But I think it was there all the time for humanity to discover. And Bill and Bob just, they were brushing away the pieces that weren't necessary, but it was a whole thing. It came to the world in one piece, and they discovered it. It was like digging up ruins, and they found it. And it's kind of the secret of life, to tell you the truth. And gradually, and when the traditions came in and that kind of thing, it preserves that. And I think AA has been very vigilant in keeping that in place, because had that not happened, I mean, these guys were flying by the seat of their pants. They didn't know. They were forming this thing. What, you know, they didn't have a template. They were creating a template or discovering the template to, for all of us to be sober from. All of us got to be part of that. And how many... It's got to be billions of people have been lost to alcoholism, either through codependency, through killing themselves, killing other people, disease and all of that stuff has all been lost. These billions of people who had an opportunity, who could have been, you know, resurrected from being an alcoholic, living an awful, pathetic life of an active alcoholic. All of those people, all of these families, everyone has been saved from that. And I do believe it is a global kind of thing. And I don't think that it was random. I do believe it was divinely inspired. And it was given to these people to be able to bring it forward to all of us, to all our families, to everyone else and every other thing. And I take that to heart. After I got sober for a while, I had faith that it worked, obviously, because it was working in my life. I got married in AA, married a man who was born on December 25th. Slight misogynistic thing going on there. I got divorced 14 years later because he went out and had a slip and basically destroyed a family. So I've seen it up close and personal from both sides. My children are fabulous, by the way. And so I took some time off from relationships, and then I got married again. To a man who was born on December 25th, but was 20 years younger. When were you born? But that didn't quite work out. We were married a couple of years, but unfortunately I had to give a fluffy go. But I've done everything that I've ever wanted to do in AA. I've done every kind, you know, I'm still a parent. All my children are grown and that kind of thing. I've done everything that I ever wanted to do as far as my life goals are concerned. And I'll tell you what, now I trust the program. I have not found anything in the big book that's not true so far. W.C. Fields was looking through his Bible when he was on his deathbed going... And his friend said, "What are you doing? You're an atheist. What are you looking through that for?" And he says, "I'm looking for loopholes." And I think, you know, I still read the big book because I am kind of looking for loopholes. Something that's not true so far. And again, divinely inspired. These guys were 5 years sober. I wouldn't have written a recipe when I was 5 years sober about, you know, how to save yourself in the world, which is basically what AA is doing. And that came through. And I do have absolute trust in it now. I see people who've been sober for that are in terrible straits who get sober and leave absolutely in phenomenally productive lives, helping other people. I think the part of service is so important in AA. If you just sit there, it's sort of like a wheel. It has to go forward. And if you just sit and don't do service or give back to another people, you just kind of rock it in one place. And to keep it moving, that part of bringing in other people and putting yourself out to another person altruistically is so important, what keeps us here. The structure of the steps holds the person together. The structure of the traditions holds us together. We are a community without borders. We don't judge by what you make or what you do or who you are or where you came from. You're measured by, are you sober today? Can you help another alcoholic? We never say, ever, I'm never going to drink again. In fact, like I said in the book, it says, go drink again. You never say, I'm not going to drink again, but which I take to heart, and this is kind of the heart and soul of my sobriety, is that we do take a pledge. It's not to not drink. It is that when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. Thank you.